Should I just stop? Thank you very much. So I understand Rob has sort of filled in on some of the motivation, but let me just go through my motivation for thinking about this issue. So one question that John Wheeler asked was, why the quantum? You know, why does quantum theory take the particular form it does? You know, when you look at the standard axioms of quantum theory, they're quite abstract, such as, you know, a quantum state is given by a density matrix, which is an operator on a complex Hilbert space. And then you have the formula for probabilities given by the trace rule. And you have the general maps are completely positive maps, unitary transformations being a special case. So why all that structure? Where does it come from? And the situation is often compared with the situation before 1905, when you had the Lorentz transformations, a sort of mathematical, abstract-looking set of transformations. You know, why would those be the correct transformations of nature? And then Einstein came along and gave two postulates, and then it became clear that those were very sensible transformations in spite of their apparent mathematical complexity. Another example is Kepler. Kepler had his three laws of planetary motion, and if you looked at those three laws, they were kind of odd. You know, why should the vector sweep out equal angles in equal time? Why the particular power law for period versus distance? And the explanation for those laws came from Newton. You know, in terms of his universal law of gravitation and his laws of mechanics, and they provided the very natural explanation for why Kepler's laws were the way they were. So it seems like a good thing to do to ask why you have a particular structure, especially when that structure is perhaps more abstract. Please.
Is this like analog for the asking general relativity? Why do we use a metric
that good question.
Yeah. Is it the same kind of question?
Like one might argue that the metric is better motivated in terms of the equivalence principle and so on. But I do agree that there's a similar sort of question to be asked there if you can reduce general relativity to some very natural set of perhaps more compelling postulates.
Are there people who are worried about
that? I'm worried about that. I think there's a few people. There's a nice paper by John Baez and Emery Byrne called The Meaning of Einstein's Equations, which is not so much about why the equations are that way, but giving a more intuitive interpretation of those equations. I think it's an important question, and it's something that I want to address. But for this for this talk, for this lecture, let me stick with quantum theory. And of course, you could also ask, you know, why are Maxwell's equations the way they are, any of those questions, and maybe you can gain deeper insight into really looking for deeper reasons for such equations. So why do this? Well, one reason to do this is just that you may gain a deeper insight into the equations, and that's, you know, a very satisfactory thing to do. Feels good. But another, perhaps more important reason is that it can help you make progress beyond the current physics to the next physics. So in the case of quantum theory, the obvious thing we want to make progress towards is quantum gravity, which is incidentally why I'm interested in doing something similar for general relativity. So if you have a deeper understanding of where the equations are coming from in the current theory, then perhaps you can see how to apply to a wider range of situations. So in the case of Kepler's laws, once you get Newton's equations, you are able to get not just the equations for elliptical motion, which, you know, Kepler's laws are restricted to that situation, but the equations for hyperbolic motion, where a planet or whatever, not a planet, a rock is coming in from infinity. and perhaps, and also in the case of Lorentz transformations, by taking Einstein's approach, it can be argued, I think, that that made the step from special relativity to general relativity more possible. I think it would have been difficult to go directly from the Lorentz transformations. Okay, so this is something I've been working on for a while, for 10 years. So 10 years ago, I wrote a paper. Who's been disappointed that I didn't get zero here? That's what I'm going to talk about today. I've been working on this sort of on and off in an obsessive compulsive way for the last 10 years. Recently I feel I've made a lot of progress, and I was hoping, so when Rob asked me to give this talk, I asked him if I could have a few more days, because I'm hoping that I'm very close to a new set of accents, which I think are much better, although I've often been very close. So this is. So I'm working currently on a new paper. So that'll be 10 ?? I'm hoping at least this it will be this year. This year. So I'm very close. There's a small gap in the proof, so I can't present those new axioms to you today. So that's kind of painful. So it's difficult to go back and talk about the work from 10 years ago. But I still think that the work from 10 years ago is interesting. There's been progress also by other people. So the work from 10 years ago, the thing that I've been struggling to do all these years is get rid of one of the axioms or replace it with something different. The last axiom is called the simplicity axiom, and I don't like it. And there's been some progress recently in removing the axiom. So these people, Dakic and Bruckner, have shown how to get rid of it by having another axiom. I don't especially like their new axiom, but I think it's better than just having the simplicity axiom. And then these people, and Muller, have written another paper, which I think tidies up this paper. I think there's a few holes in this paper, and they have a different axiom again, but they use the same idea as this paper to get rid of the simplicity paper. This is Marcus Muller, who's a postdoc at Perimeter. And then just very recently, these people have written another paper. They take a slightly different approach to the one in this, but there's a lot of similarities, and they've removed the simplicity axiom in their own way. And again, this guy, Giulio Chiravella, is a postdoc at Perimeter. So we're slowly grabbing all the people, all the experts around the world, and bringing them to Perimeter and making them postdocs. But there's been other work as well on this sort of axiomatics recently. If you're interested in it, you can look at, there was a conference we held, and the talks are on PERSA. I think that was in 2009. Okay, so let me tell you about the 2001 paper. And I'll just go through the axioms and some of the theoretical background. I won't give you the full derivation. That would take far too long. But I'll try to motivate it and explain where the structure of quantum theory comes from with these axioms. OK. So I'll give you. So the first axiom is kind of essential, really, if you're going to do anything. Probabilities. I'll use this blackboard. Can everyone see is to that fluid length, to that distance. So really, I should use tablets of stone for the axioms, but this will have to do. Axiom 1. So here's the idea. This concerns probability. If I have some preparation, Rob has told you about this sort of kind of operational ideas where you have boxes representing preparations, transformations, and measurements. So if I have some preparation, followed by a measurement, system travels from the preparation to the measurement. Incidentally, everybody who works in this kind of area has their own favorite convention for which direction systems travel. So some people have them traveling to the side, which I think is the convention Rob adopted. Some people have them traveling up. Some people have them traveling down, and very few people have them traveling in that direction. So I've now adopted this convention. So here's a preparation. So this is a device, it's a box. It has some settings on it you can use to change the thing that you prepare. It also has something I call a release button. The idea is if you press this button, then a system is released. So this is a knob. So this could be, like an oven that releases atoms. And when you press the release button, you open and close a shutter. And as long as the density of the atoms is sufficiently low, you'll just release one atom, for example. And then over here, we have a measurement device. So this, again, can have some settings on it, some knob settings. This could be, for example, a stone Gerlach apparatus. In that case, the knob setting would just be the angle at which you rotate the apparatus. Then also it has a bunch of outcomes. Okay, I'll just represent those by the other things on the side. And I'm going to make one outcome special. I'll call this the null outcome. The null outcome is the thing that always happens if you don't press this button. So then there's no system impinging on the device and nothing happens. And we call nothing happening the null outcome. Okay. So here's the axiom. The axiom says that P, defined as the limit as n goes to infinity of n. N is the number of runs, the number of times you repeat the experiment. N on the denominator, and then n sub O, where O is some particular outcome. So n sub O is the number of times you see some particular outcome along here. Now this takes the same value on different ensembles. So you do the experiment, for a very large number of repetitions, tending to infinity. Then you do the experiment again the next day, perhaps. And then you do it again the next day, and this should take the same value. I'll just write each time. I'm not going to have room for five axioms on this blackboard. I'm just going to write this down here. So in some sense, it would be difficult to do very much physics if this were not true. If you tossed a coin a million times on Monday and you got 75% heads, then you toss the same coin in the same way a million times on Tuesday, and that time you only got 37% heads, then it would be very difficult to sort of create a physical theory that could really apply to that situation. So something like this is a prerequisite for doing probabilistic physics.
Is this some sort of saying that time is homogeneous?
Yeah, you could think of it like that. Your ensemble, so the way I'm presenting it, your ensemble, each of your ensembles is bounded in time. You could perhaps select your ensembles across space-time in any arbitrary way, as long as you're randomly choosing without knowledge of the outcome, your ensemble. So perhaps it's an even stronger homogeneity than that. Yep.
So you prepare the decision the same way, or you just pick a random one preparation?
You're preparing it in the same way. So you go through the same operational procedure. You build the same box, or you buy the box from the same shop, and you use it in the same way each time. And likewise for the measurement device.
So you kind of assume that preparation is time.
That's right. Yeah. It's but it'd be even stronger than that. But yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think so. I'm presenting this as if it's a very necessary thing to do physics. Actually, I think when you start to look at quantum gravity, I think you have to be a bit more careful, even about this axiom. But let's.
You should talk to an experimentalist. That's the main thing, right? Repeatability.
Repeatability.
If their experiment's not repeatable, then
it's just then they struggle harder to make it repeatable. Of course, it never is repeatable, actually, because if you look at the data, it's always slightly different. They have error bars, but what can you do? We have to have something to make progress.
I guess for quantum gravity, we have only one system?
It depends on your perspective. My perspective on quantum gravity is an operational one. The one real problem with this axiom is how do you know that this is kind of a closed system? Maybe there's something else over here that you don't have control over that's affecting your this system. So maybe on Monday it affects it in one way, and on Tuesday it affects it in a different way. So you have a kind of something closeness, and that kind of closeness makes sense if you have a definite causal background. You can sort of talk about, you can isolate a certain part of the universe, and kind of. But if you can't isolate a certain part of the universe, then it's difficult to know what that means. And so, in other papers I've written, I thought about this quite a lot. That would be too big a diversion, I think, for our current purposes. Okay. So next, let me define a notion of state. State. So a state is that thing which is given by any mathematical object you can use to calculate the probability. A state is associated with a given preparation. Each preparation will have a state. And the state is a mathematical object associated with any given preparation that you can use to calculate the probability for any measurement outcome, any measurement that you may perform. So here's a preparation. Outcomes of state. I can put on top of this some measurement of different outcomes. I want to know what the probability is. I want to know what the probability is for each outcome, and the state is something that I can use to calculate that probability for any. It's associated with the preparation. I can use it to calculate the probability for any outcome of any measurement. I think you had a question.
Yeah, it's part of a separate axiom.
I'm now giving you some of the framework so I can use that to motivate subsequent axioms. Yeah, so I finished axiom. That's a little box around it. Okay. So given that idea, that definition of what a state is, here is one object. So this is an object that could represent the state, a mathematical object. Alpha, so p sub alpha is the probability associated with the outcome of some particular measurement. And we consider all possible outcomes of all possible measurements. Each of them is labeled by a different alpha. So this label is just going over all possible outcomes of all possible measurements. And this object basically tells you everything you need to know. So therefore, it is the state. And I think Rob mentioned this object in his lecture yesterday. But this kind of contains too much information. If you had to work with this, you couldn't really do very much useful physics. So typically, physical theories are going to correlate the physical quantities that you would use the physical theory to calculate. So all these different probabilities are likely to be related to one another. So typically it should be possible to actually give a subset of all these probabilities. This is a subset, P sub k. So k is in a particular subset of all the alphas. K is an element, so this is a subset of all the possible alphas. And you should be able to choose some minimal set of such k's, so that this object contains all the information about the state. Okay. Is that clear?
Could we think of a qubit, and then what would this piece be for something?
I'll give that example. An important quantity here is the number of elements in this minimal set. And I'm going to call that k, uppercase k. Okay. So that's an important quantity. That's basically the minimal number of probabilities you need in specifying your state. Let me give some examples. So the first example is a qubit. If you look at the density matrix for a qubit, it's like this. So you've got the probability of spin up and the probability of spin down on the diagonal. And then you have A and A star on the off diagonal. And A, you can do a calculation and show that this is equal to that. I think I may have got some of the coefficient wrong. So basically this. So you can see that this A is actually a linear combination of probabilities for different measurements. And so in here you have PZ plus, PZ minus, and you also need PX plus and PY plus to get these off diagonal terms. Yep. If you have, when you say continuous value, you mean something corresponding to a continuous dimensional Hilbert space?
Yeah.
Yeah. So this set of axioms does not apply to that situation. It's strictly speaking for the case we have, let's say, finite dimensional Hilbert space. Part of the reason I say that is that there's safety in the finite place. Maybe you can take them over to the continuous dimensional case, but I don't know.
But
don't
you even have to care about continuous dimensional? Because in quantum theory, is the infinite dimensional always separable? So it's countably infinite dimensional.
I mean,
yes.
I think that in many situations that is the case. My understanding is it's not always the case.
Well,
it isn't separable.
Is there one?
Wait, sorry, is separable or isn't?
Like a physically infinite dimensional Hilbert space that exists, right? So there are systems that have.
So ones that are separable would just be, say, a harmonic oscillator. You can count the levels. Ones that are not, I think, crop up in quantum field theory. I don't have an example to hand.
So, yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Sorry?
A free particle?
Right.
Yeah, I think a free particle, like, yeah, if you put a box, then you have separable. Yeah. If you don't, then I'm not. Then maybe the situation is more complicated. Yeah. I have to admit, personally, I'm sort of, I have philosophical problems with any place where infinite, you know, you have infinite in physics anyway, and so I suspect I would like it to be the case that you ultimately get to a finite theory. Quantum, even finite dimensional Hilbert space is not a finite theory because you have amplitudes or probabilities, and these are continuous numbers. So it's not. But this is just about finite dimensional quantum theory. This work in axiomatics was really got going again after quantum information. So people worked on quantum axiomatics before, and they were always trying to deal with the general case where you could have continuous dimensional Hilbert spaces. And I think it's difficult to deal with that case. And in the finite case, you can get a lot more insight into the structure. So some of the people working in the previous approaches would regard the finite dimensional case as trivial. And you know, that's a perspective. But it's the finite dimensional case that really underlies all of quantum information. So it's very, I think it's very instructive to look at finite dimensional cases. Even if you think that ultimately you need to go to the infinite dimensional case. Okay. So yeah, I was given this example. So you can see that this object this is the probability of z plus, probability of z minus, probability of x plus, probability of y plus. Incidentally, in Rob's lectures, he calls this S. In my original paper, I called it P, and I'm going to stick with my original notation. This object contains the same information as this object, and therefore is just as good a way of representing the state. So this represents the state. And so you can see in this case, k is equal to 4. Okay. And you can try and draw a picture of that. So if you're going to draw a picture, there's four coordinates here, so let me just impose normalization. So the sum of the first two is equal to 1, and then I can draw a picture in three dimensions. And in that case, that's a cube, a unit cube. And these are px plus, py plus, pz plus. And the allowed states in quantum theory for a qubit, for a spin half particle, have to lie either on or in the sphere that fits just exactly inside this unit cube. So you take the unit cube, you put a sphere that fits just inside it. And now the only states that are allowed are ones that are either sitting on the surface or inside the sphere. And this is basically the block ball translated into different coordinates. Any questions on this?
What if we just need those three variables then? Because if we have PC plus, we always want PC.
So it turns out to be very convenient not to impose normalization on your states. So one way to think of that is, over there I talked about the release button. If you don't always press it, if in creating your ensemble you only press it a certain fraction of the times, then your total probability will be less than 1 for the non-null outcomes. It turns out to be very useful. In standard quantum theory, after a measurement you get a state, or after a transformation you get a state, for example, a projection. And then you have to renormalize the state. But if you just consider the unnormalized state that you get after a transformation, then the sum of these two numbers is less than 1.
Right. Remember you then the number for the probability of null?
Well, then that is given by 1 minus the sum of these two.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. And so what really happens is when you look at these spaces, you have the free sphere sitting on top of a cone going down to the origin. And these cones are typical. You have some space of normalized state sitting at the end of the cone going down to the origin. Another example is a classical probability theory. So for example, imagine you have a coin with three sides, a dice with three, whatever, something with three sides. Then you have one probability for each side, and you can P1, P2. In this case, so the state is given by P1, P2, P3. The normalized states lie in this triangle, and then the null state lies at the origin. So in this case, you can actually see the cone. You have a space of normalized states in this space going down to the origin. And if you look at these two examples, in the quantum case, you can see that any state that's on the surface of this sphere is a pure state. Has Rob covered pure states?
Yeah.
Okay. So a pure state is one that cannot be simulated by a mixture of other states. So there's actually a continuous set of pure states. If you take two points, there's a continuous set of pure states between them. In this case, there's only a finite number of pure states. Three, in that case. In the quantum case, once you go above a qubit, if you go to something having a higher dimensional Hilbert space, then it gets more complicated. It's interesting. So in this case, every point on the surface of this shape is a pure state, is an extremal state. But in the case where n is equal to 3 or higher, that's no longer the case. You get kind of flat sides. So the space, the shape of Hilbert space is you know, something that's interesting to think about and difficult really to visualize above the case of the qubit. Okay. Any more questions? Good. So you can ask what's the probability, given that you perform some particular measurement and you have some particular state. And Rob told you yesterday that that's just given by some vector R. It's just given by a linear function like this. Okay, and that comes from convexity, comes from thinking about mixtures. So I won't go through the proof of that. It's fairly simple proof. So what this means now is that you have associated with every state you have some vector, and associated with every measurement you have a vector. And you take the dot product of those two vectors, you get the probability. Okay. So next I need to introduce another number, n. Let's see, how is that? So n is the maximum number of states in any set that can be distinguished in a single shot measurement. In quantum theory, for example, if you have a spin half system, then the maximum number of states you can distinguish in any measurement is two. For example, they could be spin up and spin down along the z direction. In classical probability theory, this example, the maximum number of states you can distinguish is three in this example. So one state would be the state where you prepare the system so it's definitely, say, you're going to come up on one of the three sides of the coin, heads, tails, and I'm not sure what the other one would be, and so on. So in general, you can imagine here all possible preparations, and then I'm going to consider subsets of possible preparations, and I'm going to send, label them by n equals 1, 2, up to some n. And then I consider some measurement device over here. I have outcomes, ignore the null outcome. And then corresponding to each n is a disjoint set of outcomes. And so on. So if I have a special measurement, I can distinguish this set of states. Any questions about that? And in quantum theory, a set of such states would be a set of states corresponding to a particular basis of your Hilbert space, because they can be distinguished in a single shot measurement.
So we have these kind of more fuzzy sort of measurements, the POVFs, and where, you know, sometime. So is that kind of covered in this sort of work,
So generally, so you might ask what kinds of measurements can do this, and generally speaking, these will be in quantum theory, they will be the projection values measurements, or maximal measurements. They won't be the more general POVMs, except of course.
You can make the POVMs out of these.
In general, these will be the standard measurements that you study in undergraduate quantum theory. Any more questions? Okay, and then what you can do is, if you have a general state that you send in onto this measurement device, not necessarily one of these states, you can say that you've constrained your state to what you might call an informational subset, if it can only give rise to a subset of the outcomes associated with this. So for example, maybe it can only give rise to these outcomes. So in quantum theory, for example, if you have a five-dimensional Hilbert space, but if you constrain your state so that it belongs to a three-dimensional subspace within that five-dimensional Hilbert space, then an appropriate measurement would only ever give you outcomes relating to three of the five possible basis states. And this is a sort of general operational notion. So that's n. N is the maximum number of distinguishable states for your system type. In the case of, you know, a dice, n is equal to 6. In the case of a coin, n is equal to 2. In the case of a Q-trit, a three-level Hilbert space, n is equal to 3, and so on. Okay. So axiom 2. And I can see I'm going to have to hurry up and get some 5 axioms. Systems having, or constrained to have, the same n have the same properties. So for example, if you have a five-dimensional Hilbert space and you constrain yourself only to states in some three-dimensional subspace, then those states, then that system will behave like a system having n equal to 3. If you have two different examples of systems having, for example, n equal to 2, then they will have the same properties. So for example, the polarization degree of freedom of a photon corresponds to a two-dimensional Hilbert space, as does the spin degree of freedom of a spin half particle. And you have the same properties in those two cases. Yeah.
Sorry, it's kind of stupid, but what if, like, in both those cases, if they've got 50% probability in certain measurements and stuff, right? But what if, like, one's always more likely to come out?
So I'm talking about the full set of states that have or constrained to have a certain n. So the full set of states, for example, the full set of states from polarization degree freedom of a photon contains a range of states. In fact, it's basically the Bloch sphere. And likewise, the full set of states for a spin half particle is the same thing. It's the Bloch sphere.
Could you specify what you mean by properties?
That's a good question, yeah. So what I mean by properties is the shapes of the status, the shape of the state space. So in the case of a qubit, that was a sphere. In the case of a classical system, it's a simplex. And also the state, the shape of the space of these things, of the measurement vectors. So things having the same shapes for these different spaces have the same properties. Any more questions? Good. I call this the information axiom. Because it's basically saying that systems that have or constrained to have the same information carrying capacity have the same properties. The next axiom, axiom three, concerns composite systems. This one's simple. Imagine we have a system that consists of two components, A and B. Then I make this assumption. We assume that the maximum number of distinguishable states for the composite is given by the product of the number for each of the two systems. If you have a system consisting of a dice and a coin, then n for the dice is 6 and n for the coin is 2, and the total number of distinct possibilities for the composite system is 12. This part of the axiom is just saying that when you put two things together, new properties don't emerge. It's possible that when you put two systems together, new properties emerge that weren't there previously. The second one is saying something similar. What's interesting is that the second property is true in quantum theory if you have complex Hilbert space. If you have real Hilbert space, then KAB is greater than KA times KB. For real Hilbert space. And for quaternions, if you have quaternionic Hilbert space, then it's the way around, less than.
Sorry, what is K in this case?
K is the number of fiducial probabilities you require to specify the state. So the state is given by a vector, has a certain number of probabilities in it. You know, in the example I gave you with a qubit, the number of probabilities was equal to 4. That's that. So if you look at two qubits, the number of probabilities required to specify the full state, the full space, is 16. You need 4 for each of the two systems.
So this kind of explains why we don't see a quantum mechanics of the reals, or excludes that possibility. Right?
Yeah, so certainly from the point of view of this axiom, it excludes that, yeah, within this axiomatic set. This axiom is very compelling. I'm not sure I have time to explain to you just how compelling this is. But it's related, it's the same as another property that sometimes goes by the name of local tomography. Local tomography is the idea that you can determine the state of a composite system by making local measurements on its parts. And if local tomography isn't true, then you start to get into physical theories which are sort of non-local in a strange way, that you can't really characterize the whole by making measurements on the parts.
Can you exclude the hidden variable theories by these axioms?
No. I mean, it depends exactly what you mean. So if you say hidden variable theories have to be subject, the hidden variables themselves have to be somehow subject to all the axioms that I give you, then yes. But if you say no, just the emergent theory from those hidden variables has to be subject to these axioms, then the answer is no. Okay. So that's the third axiom. Run down this axiom one. So two more to go. Axiom four. So the fourth axiom says that there does exist a continuous reversible transformation between any pair of pure states. So you can remember for the Bloch sphere, the ball inside here, if you have the pure states on the surface, and I can go from this state to this state continuously by applying a reversible transformation. And so this axiom is just making that a principle. So you can see immediately that this doesn't apply to the classical case. If I want to get from this state, this pure state, to this one, I would have to somehow jump. It cannot go continuously. And so this is the axiom that's ruling out the classical case. Okay.
One can argue that the classical case of a dice is actually an idealization of a continuous case, coarse-grained.
Yeah. Right.
So one probably thinks, I mean, the dice going from one state to from up to down, or it actually goes through a continuous transformation.
Right.
So if I look at a bigger classical system, then of course it has an infinite number of degrees of freedom, but then.
I mean, so this is really. I think there's a point that needs to be that's important here. I mean, it could also be that the continuous case is really an idealization of a deeper underlying discrete case. And so, from the point of view of these axioms, I'm just considering the discrete case. Okay. At this level of talk now. I guess I believe that deep down there is actually a discrete case, and so that's okay. But if that's not the case, then the point you're making would undermine just how fundamental these axioms should be taken to be. In the new axioms I have, I don't have this axiom, and suddenly the continuity idea has been criticized. Interestingly, even at the level of these axioms, you don't really need the full if you take, for example, the transformations on a ball, then you ask what states can be mapped onto each other by a group. So because we have reversible transformations, it will be a group. Well, there aren't that many finite groups. The finite groups essentially correspond to the finite solids. There's a few cases where you have, like, you know, one point here, and points around the equator. But there aren't that many finite groups anyway. And so you could probably modify these axioms to say there exists a reversible transformation which is not too jumpy, you know, and that would give you the same thing, because as long as the change in probability after each of these small transformations is smaller than a certain amount, then really the only option you have is to go to the continuous group, because there aren't that very many. finite groups. Okay. So just before I give you axiom 5, let me just motivate it. So from these axioms, we can say that k has to be a function of n. K is one of the properties of your space of states. And we have, by axiom 2, that these properties are the same, the systems having the same n. So k must be a function of n. You can also show that that has to be true. Sorry. You can't show that's true. Sure, that has to be true. This isn't so obvious, but it's fairly straightforward to show. And it seems pretty reasonable, I think, that the number of properties you require, is bigger if you have a bigger n. Then from axiom 3, we can show k of n a n b has to be equal to k of n a times k of n b. This is a property in number theory which is called complete multiplicability. This function is complete multiplicative. And if you take these properties, you can show that k is what's that called? Okay. So what's interesting here is that the first two cases are familiar. If r equals 1, then we have classical probability theory. You can see in the classical case, the number of probabilities is just equal to the number of distinct states that you have. And r equal to 2 is the quantum case. You can check this just by counting the number of real parameters in the general density matrix. And this is true, of course, only if you have complex Hilbert space. And then what about the higher cases? 3, 4, 5, 6, okay. That's where I've been struggling for the last 10 years. Either they do exist and you can construct them, and I've tried to show that, or they don't exist, in which case you can rule them out, and I've tried to show that. I didn't really make any progress. As I said, recently a few people have found axioms that do eliminate the higher cases, so there has been progress in the last year or so on this subject. Now, it's still conceivable that there may actually exist higher theories that can be constructed that are still consistent with some reasonable set of postulates. In any case, for my purposes, the fifth axiom is the simplicity axiom. And that just says that k takes the smallest value for each n that's consistent with the other axioms. Okay, and I don't like that axiom, but that was the one I needed to just restrict ourselves down to the simplest case. Now, we've ruled out already the r equals 1 case, because that's inconsistent with this continuity property. So we have to go to the r equals 2 case, and then you can show that with these axioms, you can actually construct the full structure of quantum theory. What I mean by the full structure of quantum theory is that states are represented by density matrices on a complex Hilbert space, acting on a complex Hilbert space. That composition is given by the tensor product, that probabilities are given by the trace rule, that transformations are given by CP maps, and I think that's it. What you don't get is a particular Hamiltonian. This is a more abstract framework than that.
So can you just restate that
axiom? Yeah, let me just write it down. So K takes the smallest value for each n, which is consistent with your axioms. And the only reason I have the axiom is because I want to show that R is equal to 2. In other words, K is equal to N squared.
So, has anybody been able to come up with a theory which is consistent with these axioms, which is not quantum?
No. People have tried and come close. They have theories that that are not completely crazy, but they're not consistent with all these axioms. So in particular, this axiom, to the information axiom, is very difficult to build into your theory. It's actually a fairly restrictive axiom.
It's very shocking because I would have thought that would have been one of the easiest things.
Yeah, but when you form a system from a composite, and then you restrict yourself down to something now having constrained in this way, then it probably won't have the same properties as an individual system. Yeah, was enough, yeah.
Is the continuity property in axiom 4 related to the Schrödinger equation? Or
yeah, you could say that. So, my motivation for the continuity property is that whenever you transform a system, typically you're bringing your system into a place where you have a field, like a classical field or something, acting on it as it transverses through that. through that region. And you could interrupt that at any point in time. If you interrupt it, at a certain time, it should have evolved a certain amount. If you interrupt it at an earlier time, it should have evolved a smaller amount than that. And so consequently, if you interrupt it infinitesimally, you really shouldn't see discrete jumps. You'd expect to see a kind of continuous evolution of the system. That's what you get with Schrödinger's equation. So definitely this is very consistent with Schrödinger's equation, and I think there's a strong physical motivation for this kind of continuity in physics.
So, I guess on that basis, like if you've got some system you want to solve, like some Hamiltonian, can you actually do it using these axioms? Like the axioms you'd normally have, like with states and so on, you can quite readily just say, okay, so I write it down, bang, I get an actual numerical answer.
Right.
Seems a bit more abstract. So.
Yeah, I don't think you can do that here. I mean, that would be very good if you found a set of axioms that could help you solve certain problems. I don't know of any instances of that here. You might imagine you could use these kinds of axioms to prove certain general properties that quantum theory has without going into the full structure of quantum theory. And people have done that kind of thing.
So most of it is slightly said that, how Newton's laws explain Kepler's mathematical framework on actual physical things, but this isn't really the same thing, is it?
So I don't think the set of axioms I've given you here are anything like as compelling as what as Einstein's postulates or Newton's postulates. First of all, I wouldn't be that immodest, but even so, I don't believe that there's anything like in the same category. So I think this kind of project is still very much open. I think that and these axioms don't make it obvious what to do next. How to go from there's no example like the hyperbolic motion. That these axioms give you that standard quantum theory doesn't. I think this is very much an intermediate step towards something more compelling than I would hope we can come up with. One thing about this kind of axioms in general is they're going to be less physical than the other cases, like the Lorentz transformations or the all the cases of Newton's laws and Kepler's laws, because quantum theory is a very general theory. It applies to a wide range of physical situations. So you better not take some kind of physical principle that only applies in one of those situations, you know, when quantum theory is actually a very, very general framework for physical theories. So they're going to be a bit more abstract than perhaps one is used to.
It seems that these axioms are still very much operational in the sense
yeah.
that they just tell you what happens if you do an experiment.
Yeah.
And it seems that the axioms that, well, say Newton's laws, right, are very different in that sense.
Yeah.
Like they actually make a statement about the physical world that isn't necessarily related to experiment directly. So do you think that taking this kind of approach will eventually lead to axioms that could be as enlightening?
So yeah, that's a great question, and it's something I struggle with a lot. So when I started in this business of quantum foundations, I was very much a realist. So I believe that what you need, I think Rob's talked about these different approaches. What you need is some underlying theory, and then you get quantum theory out of that. And so I think at some point you'll cover the de Broglie-Bohm model, which is an idea where you actually have physical trajectories, particles really follow the trajectories, and you can make that consistent with quantum theory. Whilst that particular example is a bit too simple, I feel it's in the right spirit. So when I came up with these axioms, I was sort of thrown into a quandary, because it seems strange that operational axioms like this can give you so much of the structure of quantum theory. You know, when you think that you need deeper axioms to get the structure, really. The attitude I've come to take is that thinking operationally is a methodological thing. That if you're trying to make progress in physics, then you have to be a bit opportunistic and try to find ways that are good and that help you come up with new mathematical structures. And the advantage of operationalism is that as long as you apply operational concepts correctly, you don't see anything that's wrong, because you're just describing how experiments are. And so you can construct mathematical models for physical theories, frameworks for physical theories, at an operational level, and they will contain something that's useful. But my hope is that in the long run, this operational approach will lead you to some sort of insight that is more ontological, like realist in its nature. So that's a long answer to your question.
So you think this is going to eventually lead to something?
Yeah. I think my feeling is that won't happen within quantum theory itself. You know, people have struggled for many years with these sorts of questions in quantum theory, and I'm not satisfied with any of the answers that people have come up. I think it will be in the context of quantum gravity, where we see a clash between different sorts of fundamental structures that this will be eventually resolved. I hope it will be resolved. I'd be disappointed if the ultimate understanding has to be entirely operational in nature, and that we can't have a deeper understanding in terms of something underlying all that, some real things. Because I don't know what that means. It's very odd to think that the only proper understanding of the world would be entirely operational. That's a strange.
Any realist claim will depend on some experiment.
Any what, sorry?
Realist claim
will
depend on some experimental evidence. I don't know, atoms. Mm-hmm. Like all the evidence is about atoms.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that give atoms like a realist.
Yeah, that's right.
So, is it that really possible to get to that?
Get beyond that, you mean?
Yeah, I mean, like, to really find some. Some experiments don't claim that will support those realist ideas?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think there have been times at which people thought, well, we have like the atomic model, statistical physics, and this looks fairly compelling. You have atoms or whatever really behaving in some way that's like this, and you can get the laws of thermodynamics from that. But then later physics comes along and says, well, that wasn't really quite the right picture that you had. It was only approximate. And so whether you can really ultimately go beyond that kind of going backwards and forwards between these two points of view is a good question. I would hope you can, but you know, I can't really even think of a strong example where one has. You know, any? Yeah, I mean, I finished, so. I meant to say, yeah, if anyone's interested in this sort of things, I'm always very happy to talk to people, so just email me and we can talk if that's something that anyone is interested in. It's a very active research area at the moment, and I think it could be, it could end up bearing some real fruit when it comes to moving beyond quantum theory. But I'll leave it at that.
Lunch with us.
All right, have lunch.
And maybe you can ask some questions during the lunch. Okay. And sorry, we're so